Welcome to the ONC PCORE Research Data User Scenarios Group Meeting Number 4. My name is Hilda, and I will be your operator for today. At this time, all participants' lines are unmuted. Please self-mute your lines. If you wish to ask a question, please use the WebEx to raise your hand or send your questions to Catherine Donaldson via the chat function. If you are not signed into WebEx and you wish to ask a question, please announce yourself on the phone, stating your name and affiliation. Please also note that this conference is being recorded. I will now like to turn the call over to Priscilla Dulab.
Thank you very much. So good afternoon, everyone, and I guess good morning for the folks on the East Coast. This is Priscilla. Welcome, everyone, to the fourth multi-stakeholder meeting for the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Privacy and Security Research Data Use Scenario Project. So my name is Priscilla, and joining me on the call, we have some fellow NORC colleagues. We have Eric, Koppelroot, Kathleen, and Gargan. Our colleagues from GW include Lara Cartwright-Smith, Elizabeth Gray, and Jane Thorpe. We also have Daniela Mika, Joanna Singorano on the call, and joining us from ONC, we have Helen and Davey as well. We also have some of the members of our multi-stakeholder group on the phone. And again, given the large number of participants on the call, we are not going to be asking everyone to introduce themselves. I'm just going to quickly make note of who we have. And, you know, we will certainly take note of your presence, you know, as you dial into the WebEx. So right now we have Dennis McCarthy from OHSU, we have Jeremy Maxwell, we have Lauren from the Office of the National Coordinator, we have Lauren Milner from the National Institutes of Health, we have Ed Hammond, we have Gloria Pollack, we have Gray Patrick Lake, Kevin Haynes, Alexa Lamarez, Lucilla Ono Machado, Jim Walker, and I see Carmen Rosa as well. And for anyone that I have not announced, just let Catherine know you are on the call, and we will certainly include you in the list of meeting attendees. Okay? So for the call today, there are sort of four areas that we are going to be focusing on. We will walk through two research use scenarios focused on behavioral health. You know, we have worked with offline with both Leslie Francis and Dennis McCarthy and Eric Koppelroot to build out these scenarios, so we will be discussing them in some detail. And then we will use this as a basis to build out the use cases around them. We will also revisit the combining data research use scenarios and discuss the changes we have made based on the feedback that we received on the last meeting. As always, we are interested in hearing from, you know, the participants and the multi-stakeholder group on any additional scenarios, you know, you would like this group to consider. So, you know, we welcome your participation and contributions in this regard. And then finally, we are going to give you an update on some additional scenarios that we will be working on in the coming weeks, so you have sort of a good sense of where things are moving. And then I'll sort of wrap up with some process and logistics updates. Okay? So I guess just this is just mostly a reminder for folks on the phone. When we met the last time, you know, we had shared with you that there are some key questions that are going to be pertinent for all of the research data use scenarios that we are developing. So I'm not going to go through these in, you know, any level of specificity, but really to sort of remind everyone that, you know, these are sort of the dimensions that are of interest. So, you know, who, what, and why, to understand how the data is moving between sort of the different parties. We are very interested in sort of understanding the agreements that govern the data movement between the parties sharing or exchanging data. You know, consent is sort of an important consideration for the research use scenarios. You know, how was the consent obtained, for what uses of that data, and what was the process for obtaining, you know, the consent or the waiver. And then, you know, we are also very interested in sort of understanding, you know, what might be the challenges or issues associated with, you know, you undertaking sort of your research efforts, okay? So again, just as a reminder, these are sort of the key questions that we will be including in all of the scenarios that we build out. Okay. So at this time, I'm actually going to hand it over to Eric, Iona, and Daniela. And, you know, we are looking to you to sort of discuss the first scenario that we have keyed up, and that's on the behavioral research use scenario. So this is the one on the integration of behavioral health data with physical health data. Okay. So for all of our meeting participants, you should be able to see sort of the Confluence website where we have sort of a written expression of the scenario. Eric, I'm going to hand it over to you, and you can sort of walk out of the scenario.
Sure. So just a little context for this, and also context for the second scenario as well when we get to that. The context for why this is a worthwhile or interesting study is that repeated research and evaluations of public sector programs serving people with serious mental illness have shown that people served in these sectors die on average 25 years younger than their peers, and that about two-thirds of that mortality is coming from medical conditions that are not directly associated with their mental illness. A significant portion of it may be associated with the medications that are being taken for their psychiatric conditions. Also, that about 80% of the healthcare costs spent for Medicaid beneficiaries and for others, commercial sector, who are seriously mentally ill, are for medical services, not for mental health or psychiatric services or for the pharmaceuticals associated with it. Therefore, it's been really an issue of evaluation and research concern about whether it is possible to impact health outcomes for people with serious mental illness by making a closer connection between medical services and mental health services, or integration of primary care and behavioral health care services. So this evaluation that we are use case is to evaluate the impact of putting these services together. The research or the evaluator will be combining data from an electronic health record, EHR, at a mental health institution with claims data from the state's MMIS, and also with survey and biometric data that is directly derived from the patient, and putting that into one data set for a SAMHSA, for an HHS-funded study. So just to emphasize, there will be three data streams brought together for this research. EHR data from the mental health facility, the state Medicaid MMIS data linked for this patient, and also direct survey and biometric data directly collected from the patient. The researcher, Max, submits the protocol to NORC's IRB to get approval to conduct the study. He establishes the data use agreements with the mental health institution and with the state MMIS, and he will directly obtain consent from patients at the mental health institution to collect survey and biometric data and to access their mental health institute EHR and Medicaid files. Consent is reconfirmed at 6-month intervals. And should I go further in that, or is that enough shaping this up?
I think it would be helpful to go further into it.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. One issue that gets raised by this is that individuals with serious mental illness under the common rule are a protected class, and so the issues of consent are particularly noteworthy. Also, many states have mental health record privacy laws and regulations which govern what information can be shared with or without patient consent. So these will be important to keep in mind. The data use agreement with a mental health institution allows MACs to collect pre-specified data fields from their EHRs for patients who have given consent. The data set is transferred from the EHR electronically to MACs. It includes the service utilization procedure codes and cost charge information. The query is run quarterly for 2 years following patient enrollment. The patient list is not de-identified when MACs receives it electronically, but it's encrypted for security and privacy purposes. He de-identifies the list upon receipt and links the EHR data from the mental health institution to the other data sets with a master linking code for all patients identified at the time of receipt. Max physically travels to the mental health institution to obtain the consent, as I mentioned, from the patient to collect the biometric and survey data. Max at that time also obtains the consent to access the Medicaid data and the EHR from the patient during that initial request. Patients are interviewed and the bioassays are taken at 6-month intervals because of the concern that we have with what is the impact of providing medical services there in the center and what is their utilization pattern. Once the MOU or the data use agreement with the state MMIS is established, MAC sends a data request to the state MMIS for all health data claims information for the patients who are enrolled in the study from the mental health institution. MACs will use patients' Medicaid identifiers to indicate which patients are included in the study. Medicaid identifier for each participant is released to MACs by the mental health institution. Medicaid receives assurance through the DUA that the patient has consented, and the Medicaid may request a copy of the consent form, which is on file with MACs. MACs requests the healthcare claims data every 6 months, which are transmitted electronically through encrypted files as specified in the DUA. All three data sets include personal health identifier and identifiable information. MACs combines all three sets by linking them with a newly generated unique identifier code specifically for the study. Unique identifiers are simple and sequential. The data is held locally at MACs's research facility. The combined set is longitudinal and used to evaluate the impact of integrating medical care into the mental health program serving seriously mentally ill adults. At the end of the study, the data are destroyed as specified with the DUA. The data may not be reused or connected with any different study.
So, Your Honor, I think at this point it might be helpful for us to sort of start, you know, collecting some more specific feedback. But before we do that, you know, are there any sort of questions on the line? I don't see any raised hands at this point, but, you know, are there any questions from participants? You're welcome to sort of unmute your lines and just ask any clarifying questions that you might have about the scenario. Yona, do you have any other follow-up questions?
No, I don't. I just wanted to specify that basically this is another starting point for us to perhaps derive one or more use case descriptions. So this particular scenario illustrates a set of systems and users interacting with each other, and it becomes the starting point for this sort of first use case analysis that you see in front of you. But it also gives us a set of common requirements that we can convey to the legal experts to put into a privacy and legal framework that would address the concerns that Eric was describing to this particular category of patients who have very significant privacy concerns.
Okay, great. So, Eric, maybe I think we should just walk through sort of the, we've gone through the description, but maybe some of the participants and the actors. as well, and then just see if there's any
right.
follow-up or feedback from our multi-stakeholder
sure. group. Okay, so the framework that we're using is the framework that you saw 2 weeks ago in the last call, and we will be molding each one of our user case studies around this frame until the point that we hear from the multi-stakeholder group that we ought to change it. So what you receive, what you'll see here is what's going to look very repetitive, and we're going to be changing specific variables and using it to tweak both what the framework is and what goes into our data sets here. So what you have is a very brief description of the project as which I went on in much greater length. The primary actor is the researcher or the end user. The supporting actors and participants are these the two data sets, the mental health institutions, EHR and the MMIS, and the participant slash patient. The only device for biometric data are blood pressure cuffs and a scale. Preconditions, these are the a set of what are things that must be in place before data can be collected, and so we've gone through what those are. One of the points in here also with what are called under HIPAA mental health notes, but in fact they include mental health and substance use records, are exempt from HIPAA disclosure. Otherwise, the HIPAA disclosure consent required for access to the Medicaid data should be sufficient. The mental health privacy regulations that govern consent for mental health information from the mental health institution are consistent within HIPAA, but may be also governed by the state mental health record privacy laws, which would need to be assessed. The mentally ill individuals are vulnerable populations, and the IRBs are required to assure that there are sufficient safeguards in place to protect the rights, welfare of subjects in this research. You'd get even an additional layer if they were individuals were pregnant or at risk for pregnancy, or prisoners or juveniles. The researcher has the IRB approval. The DUA is in place with the organization, the researchers' organization, and the mental health institution and the MMIS, and we have a direct patient consent. So these are in the preconditions. And then the unique identifiers are generated to link the data sets. The post-conditions are what happens after you get all of these things in place and are collecting the data. We have put out a number of alternatives which could sort of add wrinkles, make things more complex, and might be places where the multi-stakeholder group could say, you know, these are important areas for us to further explore. The data elements then on the next page that are included, the purpose of the data collection, which is a clinical and evaluation. The purpose of the data use is specific for IR-approved data research protocol. Terms of transfer are specified, and the terms of transfer to the researcher are specified.
Okay, sounds good. So I guess at this point we should ask, are there any sort of questions in from the multi-stakeholder group? Again, I don't see any hands raised on the WebEx, but are there any sort of questions or items that ought to be clarified around the scenario? Right.
So maybe one thing to go back to is mm-hmm. alternative one. In which in alternative one would be that the researcher does not have patient consent, and that this is there's no patient-generated information. This is strictly an analysis of Medicaid and behavioral health data. FAMHSA has funded a number of these studies. And so this, you know, to create this kind of a functionality, are there issues that would need to be surfaced because a patient consent is not derived, is not specifically given for this data use?
So again, I want to ask, are there any questions from individuals on the line? I think because at this point, if there aren't any items that require clarification on this one, then the team will, you know, sort of continue building out the use case, and we can sort of come back and, you know, discuss it with this group. We do have another use case that we've developed as well, so maybe we should move on
sure.
with that one.
Sure.
And then, you know, see if there's any feedback on that, okay?
Okay, this one is ripped from the headlines of today's paper, yesterday's paper, which is that opioid deaths now are eclipsing traffic fatalities, that for the first time in, since I think the HIV epidemic, that mortality for all ages of white non-Hispanic males, are mortality rates are increasing because of a wave of prescription opioid and opioid overdoses. This is a study, a NIDA-funded study, in which MAC's researcher wants to assess the cost-effectiveness and comparative effectiveness of several FDA-approved medications for the treatment or treatment that is psychosocial only without the use of medications for the treatment of opioid dependence among members of commercial health plans. He has the support of a commercial health plan and needs to link administrative claims data and encounter data from behavioral, medical, and pharmacy records, which are all contained and retained by the commercial health plan. Inside a commercial health plan, these databases are often segregated and require some internal linkages, even though they all are maintained by the same health plan. So what Matt's researcher needs for this study of the effectiveness of these four medications or treatment, psychosocial treatment without medications, is access to patient-level data on these behavioral, physical, and medication pharmaceutical drug claims that are stored in an integrated national database by the plan. A concurrent review of claims and utilization data will be used to identify beneficiaries with an opioid use disorder diagnosis. Patients will be eligible, and here are the eligibility criteria that are specified. All pharmacotherapy patients who meet the selection criteria will be included in the analysis, as well as a random sample of opioid use disorder patients who receive psychosocial treatment only and no medications. Pharmaceutical and laboratory utilization patterns and charges, substance use and mental health treatment utilization and charges, and medical service utilization and charges will be included during the first 6 months following the index date. So MAC will submit a proposal to his academic institution's IRB to get approval for the study. The IRB determined that the study was a secondary analysis of de-identified data and qualified for an exemption. MAC sets up DUAs with the commercial health insurer. The researcher has a DUA with the insurer that allows him to abstract pre-specified data fields from the administrative claims files. There are no specific research consents that are collected directly from the patient. This is strictly an administrative data set analysis. MAC will need to access all of these claims, medical, behavioral, pharmacy, and laboratory claims, all of which contain protected health information. Once MACS establishes the DUA with the plan, he sends the data request for all of these data for beneficiaries that meet the study inclusion criteria. The data set is de-identified as required by the HIPAA safe harbor by the plan, so it does not need the unique medical identifier. The health plan identifier is replaced by the health plan with a non-meaningful unique member number slash code. The health plan extracts data for all patients that meet the inclusion criteria. The health plan extracts, links, and de-identifies the data. It uploads the data to the claims information system using a secure FTP site where MACS is able to download the linked de-identified data to his own research information system. MACS receives all procedure codes, diagnostic codes, and claims paid for the data set. He'll receive data annually so he can study change in the use of medication, health, behavioral services utilization, and costs over time. MACS will hold the data. He combines all the data to examine changes over time in opioid agonist and antagonist therapies and psychosocial therapies. He'll assess the impacts on ambulatory emergency and inpatient care as well as pharmaceutical and laboratory use. He plans to publish in peer-reviewed journals and will share the results with the commercial plan and participating sites. At the end of the study, MACS will destroy the data set as specified in the DUA. It cannot be reused or connected for a different study.
Okay, just on a hold. Kevin, I think you have a question. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. So this is a really interesting use case. So two questions. First, would there be a date shift or something done where everything is anchored to a T0, such that you're just supplying zeros? Okay, yes. The other question is, and I find this interesting, and I just, you know, I wonder what the ethics and the legal folks think about this. This academic IRB is making the determination that, you know, this is minimum risk and then is granting a HIPAA waiver by their actions as their local privacy board. But in fact, the academic medical center does not, they're not over the covered entity of that data. So, you know, this is one of the major challenges, especially in the place where you obviously don't have consent, where you're asking some random IRB to grant a waiver of HIPAA authorization when you really need, like, the plan's IRB or a central IRB that the plan is comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Very good question.
Yeah, I think that this is Daniela. I agree that this is an important issue for us to really call out and tease apart here, because I believe that there's a lot of confusion even within sort of well-versed communities about who has the authority to grant HIPAA authorization or waive consent requirements. And I agree with Kevin that every covered entity is responsible for managing its own privacy board. And there are a number of conventions that have been established, mostly in the context of academic medical centers, where that can assign their IRB the responsibility for authorizing those kinds of releases as their privacy board. But I don't know how frequently commercial payers and other you know large payers in the public space have made those kinds of agreements where they've established a privacy board in the HIPAA sense to authorize these kinds of releases. Does anybody have experience in that space where you have either payers or non-academic centers that have had to navigate the space of identifying a privacy board that can create a waiver for research use of data?
Daniel, I don't know if anyone has already answered, but Dennis, you have your hand up, so please go ahead.
Yes, just to say that I have worked with commercial health plans, and they have used, I guess officially we didn't do this, but we could have done it and have gotten the health plan to waive to the academic IRB. Typically, a health plan wouldn't have an IRB. They can analyze these data for proprietary reasons, and do whatever they want with the data. It's the moving of the data into the academic environment that would be that enables these kinds of data to be analyzed and published for public benefit.
Right. So we have an entity which is not sensitive and hasn't been sensitized to the issues of human subjects protections, because they're, you know, these are operational data for them.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
So, Leslie, go ahead. Leslie has a question as well. Go ahead, Leslie.
Not a question. I was just going to say that our academic IRB has reviewed that kind of structure as well, and sometimes charging a fee.
The IRB, sorry, just to clarify that, the IRB charges a fee to the third party organization. Is that
a commercial organization?
Interesting.
Yeah. If it's somebody who has some connection with the university or is working with a researcher at the university, I mean, I don't know the details of that, but it wouldn't be unusual. I think it wouldn't be unusual to have an academic IRB. Or there are for-profit IRBs that out in the community that get used.
Kevin, did you have a follow-up? I see your hand is up again.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I never lowered it. But I can say that we would use a central IRB to do these types of things. But getting the DUA in place to actually let even de-identified data walk out of these walls, especially with things like cost information in, that's a big lift.
Okay. But it's not one that isn't done in trusted relationships.
It's rarely done. I mean, even though it's all de-identified, right, it's still proprietary information. I mean, it's all the same reasons why, like, you can't call up the hospital across town and say, send me all of your data on addiction patients. De-identified, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Proprietary issue.
I mean, think about the billboards that would go up on the side of the highway that says, you know, we're better at treating addiction or something, right?
Right.
I mean, I know that's taken it to the extreme. I understand that your data use agreement is going to say you're not going to use this for X, Y, and Z, but I'm just trying to outlay that. Even in a nonprofit space, this is a sensitive area, because what can the data show, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think it's, should we go into the...
Yes, I wanted to just see if there were... Leslie, I see your hand is still up, and this may be just from before.
Yeah, my bad.
Do you have any follow-up?
This is Bob Gelman. Can I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
I'm not on the WebEx. I just wonder how this scenario was affected, informed, changed, whatever, by the fact that the records look like they're subject to the substance abuse rules.
That's exactly the issue that we want to flesh up in this discussion, which is if you go to the next page of the descriptor, the question is raised here whether HIPAA 42 CFR Part 2 and state substance use privacy laws and regulations come into play into the secondary analysis, which is what we're probably going to be asking GW to look at. But even more so, does it differ by the holder of the record? In this instance, in this use case, we've specified a commercial insurer. But does 42 CFR Part 2 or state substance use privacy laws govern data that are collected by different or that are held by different entities? For example, as we say down in the alternative. Does it come into play if the study uses the state Medicaid fee-for-service data that are parked by states at Truven as part of market scan? Does it come into play if the study were to use state Medicaid data? We know from the decision by CMS that if the study uses CMS ResDAC research data sets, that Medicaid and Medicare claims diagnosis and procedure codes for substance use are redacted from those files. So CMS has made a determination that they, as holders of a research data set, have made substance use information out of bounds for the purpose of researchers, but does this also apply to, for example, state Medicaid data? Does something different happen if we're studying individuals under age 21?
Well, those all sound like good questions to me. I mean, my understanding of Part 2 is essentially it's like a roach motel. Once data checks into Part 2, it never checks out no matter where it goes. And if there is some place where the same data exists for some reason not subject to Part 2, whether one can exploit that data or should exploit that data in some other way not subject to Part 2 is a policy question. The legality may be there, but the appropriateness of that activity may not be.
And I think that's raised as well by the interpretation that CMS has made for the ResDAC, which is that the Medicaid, Medicare, and essentially the health plan that is collecting information for administrative, financial, and management and treatment purposes is not eligible to authorize researchers to use that data set, but rather it is the directors or their designee from substance use programs that hold themselves out to be substance use treatment programs under the definition of 42 CFR. So must a DUA and permission be given from the substance use treatment program director as specified by Part 2 for patient substance use information to be included in the research without the explicit patient's authorization for the use of that data?
Well, it sounds to me like you're asking a lot of the right questions.
Well, that's the purpose of this, is to ask thorny questions and then give it to GW to help us untangle them. But are we asking the right questions? Are there other questions we should be asking also into this data set, into this use case?
Eric, this is Dennis. Let me add a little bit of background. As a state employee, I had access to these data and analyzed these data for policy and planning purposes. As a university professor, if the CMS interpretation of 42.2 is upheld, then no one has access to these data unless it's the health plan itself. And we're missing quite a bit of science then. We know, for example, that people with alcohol and drug problems are more likely to use emergency services, more likely to use inpatient care. They are costing the health plan more resources. It is important to get these people into treatment and to get them into effective treatment, not only for their benefit, but for the benefit of the health plan. So there is value to the health plan for analyzing these data to determine which policies and practices are more effective, and yet CMS would prohibit that, and likely the health plans don't have the expertise to do this kind of analysis. So that's part of the quandary, I think, that we're grappling with.
Dennis? Oh,
go ahead, Ed. So basically what we've done here is to raise a bunch of thorny questions And I think this is the right progression of the way that our use cases are going to go. We're going to go from something very simple to a little more complex, and this is one that, that raises a bunch of thorny issues. So we've laid out some. If any of you identify additional thorny issues or alternatives, please send them and type them in. We need to move on to them.
Sure, no problem. Leslie, you have your hand up. Did you have a quick question or comment before we move on?
Thorny issue, how to follow up data use agreements and what needs to be in them.
Okay. And Leslie, is this what you had sort of brought up on the last call, that we need to be thinking of maybe some common requirements in the DUA that can be sort of broadly applicable? I think that was what we heard in the last meeting.
Right.
Is that
And here, whether anything special about substance abuse and mental health.
Okay, great. Okay.
Right. I think that's really important given the 42 CFR Part 2 requirements for time-dated and named individuals to be released, and whether that, what kind of DUA has to be included in that. Okay, great.
Great, thank you. So I'm going to move us along quickly. Danielle, I'm going to hand it over to you. I know as we sort of analyzed, you know, these scenarios, at least internally, there were some sort of additional topic areas that you wanted to tee up for this group. So let me hand it over to you now, okay?
Sure. Thanks, Rochella. So one of the things that happened when we were going through these two use cases, especially the first one, was that there seemed to be a large number of alternatives and considerations that might play into the ways that we could spin off some additional use scenarios. And so I hope to get some feedback from this team on what the most useful, you know, areas to dig down a little bit deeper and potentially create some new flows around as far as the way that we're handling behavioral health data and, you know, here physical health data. And behavioral health data has a lot of different meanings. I think that somebody said sort of above the neck and below the neck when we're talking about these two cases, that in general, you know, health data has some different kinds of instruments and sources that contribute to a potential data set that could be used for the analyses that Max researcher was taking interest in these two scenarios. So we had already touched upon the ethics of consent and release of data for seriously mentally ill patients. So the difference between the two scenarios that Eric presented, or one major difference, is one was subject to consent, and the other one was subject to some kind of a waiver. And I think that there's a reasonable amount of clarity around how we handle consent for populations that are not vulnerable. But how is there a way that we can deal with making a little bit more well operationalized decisions around how data is handled when seriously mentally ill patients are authorizing release, and what kinds of risks they may face that might require us to deliver a little bit more attention to things like privacy and security and the ways in which we obtain consent. So before jumping to the next bullet, I just wanted to see if anybody here had spent a significant amount of time thinking about how to address consent for data release with patients or caregivers that might be facing either temporary or some enduring mental health problems. I don't see any right now. Are there anybody? And my screen is not showing everyone though.
Then I don't see anyone's hand raised at the moment, but, you know, I think folks on the phone are welcome to unmute themselves and comment, okay?
Paul Applebaum's work.
I'm sorry, can you say that again? We did not hear you.
So this is Leslie. Paul Applebaum is the scholar who has done a great deal of work on this.
Okay. So Leslie, we can certainly follow up with, you know, with Paul, and if there's any information on his work that you want to pass to us outside of this meeting, please feel free to do so, okay? Any other comments or responses from the group?
The next issue that came up in this was and these are details of the scenarios, but I think things that are fairly difficult to actually implement in practice, and there are things that are going to be coming up in a number of upcoming initiatives that many of us are involved in. So if we're looking at obtaining consent repeatedly over time for a population of patients that would be releasing data that is coming from third-party data aggregators or data collectors, how do we address that? What are the ways in which we should be contacting patients for reauthorizing the data access as it accumulates? And what should be done if the patient or a research participant can't be contacted in a renewal of consent? You know, what kind of assumptions should be in place or should be considered, and should they be different for different levels of risk? So do we want to assume by default that they continue consent, or do we want to assume by default that they revoke consent depending on how sensitive the data is, especially potentially new data that might be coming that might actually change the sensitivity of the overall data set that a patient is contributing? And again, is there anybody that has tried to do this kind of thing before, where this repeating consent is part one of the challenges they've had to face?
Priscilla?
Yes.
Jim Walker.
Jim.
Slightly different context. When we did public polling regarding the health information exchange and granting information sharing across the health information exchange, which we had to do because of sensitive information, almost unanimously and very vehemently, people regarded any requirement of renewing consent, even at five-year intervals, as being onerous and unacceptable.
Is that published, or do we have access to that? Because I think that's
no, we didn't publish that. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. So we can dig up just to see if there's some similar publications. Because I think that, you know, it's onerous at the individual level and at the institutional level, certainly at a budget level. Given research work, the process of obtaining consent is one of the major feasibility limitations for all of these studies, and trying to understand how to make it, you know, potentially less burdensome or more streamlined, I hope is one of the products that we'll be able to.
Just to be clear, this is the members of the public thought it would be personally onerous and unacceptable. They weren't concerned about our work effort.
Right. Leslie, Francis, another place you might look there are various disease registries where parents enter their children into the registries, and when the children become adults, there's a need to re-consent them. And it's the practice on the, some IRBs require that.
Mm-hmm.
If there's an overarching protocol for entering people into registries.
Okay, we can certainly look into that. Renee Elway, I think you have your hand up. Please go ahead and ask.
Hi, sure. This is Ronnie Elway. I'm at the VA Health Services Research and Development. And, I mean, so when we are doing studies where people's data will be used over and over again, such as collecting data for a study that will then be part of a registry, we consent them for the study, but then we also have a separate consent within the consent form for the registry, where then they understand that they are consenting for their data to be used over and over again, so it doesn't require re-consent. So it's sort of like two consent forms in one. And a person can consent to participate in just the study part, and then we will not, and if they say no to the registry, then we won't enter their data into the registry, but if they consent to both parts, then their data will be in the registry, and it will no longer require repeated consent. Has anyone ever done that?
Well, actually, this is Ioana Singoreno. I know that the state of Nebraska has maintained its own behavioral health database, and they are doing something similar to what you're describing, Ronnie, which is the patient consents to have their information uploaded in the database. And then secondarily, when they see a second provider, someone other than the provider who submitted the data, they give the registry consent to release it to that provider. So it's kind of a two-step consent process. That is, one is kind of for all time, giving the registry, if you will, access, you know, permission to store the data. And then there's on a case-by-case basis, they allow specific providers to access that data.
This is Leslie. I think that's standard practice for a lot of registries.
Thank you. So I'm going to, Danielle, I'm going to move us along because I think, Ioana, you wanted to do some follow-up on, you know, what we heard on the last call on combining the data set scenario.
Well, I could give my time to this discussion if folks would like to continue, because I think this is very valuable. Mine was supposed to be just a quick status update of where we are with, you know, revising the previous use case based on the feedback we received. But it's up to you, Prashila. I think if folks have more questions, I think this is a good opportunity to keep the dialogue going.
I don't see any more questions, at least in terms of hands raised. But, you know, are there any other comments or observations on this?
Okay.
Ioana, let me give it to you, okay?
Okay, so we have just wanted to quickly let you know that everything we heard from you last time was quickly added to our use case analysis. So we heard your comments related to the involvement of the researcher and the research site compliance officer, as long as the IRB, into the creation of the data use agreement. One other thing that you indicated, and I think was reiterated this meeting, is that we need to consider the creation of some sort of default example data use agreements that could provide some consistency and help organizations spearhead this process, which tends to be quite expensive in time and resources. And another aspect of our discussion last time was we had carved out as a precondition the fact that the data sets we were combining were relying on de-identified information, and it's clearly very important to delve into how that happens and how the research unique identifier is assigned to various data sets. As you can see today also, we delved into some specific data combination use cases that are more detailed, clinical information and claim data, mental and substance abuse information, and physical data. So we were going to further refine the scope of what data sets would be combined and identify additional pre- and post-conditions based on the types of data sites and organizations that are involved. So all the input we get from you every call is reflected back into our artifacts. So you should see this sort of refinement happening from meeting to meeting. Any questions?
John, I think we will also just clarify for everyone that once, you know, we've gone through this process of refinement, we will share through, you know, the complete use cases, and then, you know, have a mechanism where people can also provide us sort of feedback either through this call or via the Confluence website, okay? So, you know, right now we're still sort of building these out, but over time, once they get finalized, you know, we'll be looking for sort of final inputs to make sure that we've captured everything of relevance.
Exactly. I think we just want to make sure that we heard everything correctly and that we've captured your feedback appropriately.
Great. Okay. So so just a, sort of a couple of wrap-up items, you know, just to give context to everyone in terms of where we stand. You know, we've already discussed the combining clinical and claims data scenario with you in some detail and have gotten feedback and are refining that, as we've discussed. We've elaborated on the behavioral health scenarios today, have gathered some additional inputs for areas of work. We will be working on some precision medicine research data use scenarios, and then we'll come back to this group and sort of explain them in the detail that we did with the behavioral health scenarios, and then seek your inputs as we define those. Coming out of the last call, you know, we heard that there might be some uncertainty in looking at the research unique identifier research use scenario, so we'll be working on that, and we'll be collaborating with a team at OMC on some of the work that they have underway already. And then the other one that, again, emerged from our last call was around sort of the mosaic effect, so we're beginning to explore that as well. We are looking for additional research data use scenarios, and we're hoping that, you know, based on the last two calls, you sort of have a sense of, you know, the kinds of things that we are looking for. So, you know, even if you have sort of initial ideas on a scenario, you know, we can get those from you, and then we can work internally to build those out, okay? So just, I guess, very briefly, what we've done is, you know, we have created a place on the Confluence website, and we will make sure that we send the link out to everyone. But on the Confluence website, you know, if anyone has ideas, so this is not something that we're asking everyone to do. We recognize people are busy. But, you know, there is a way for you to sort of submit the scenario to us as well online. So, you know, certainly outside of this call, if you have some ideas, you can certainly use this, you know, this form to send us any ideas that you might have. And it's pretty simple in terms of how we've laid it out. So feel free to go there and use that. Alternatively, you can certainly just call us and be happy to get on a call and, you know, gather any additional inputs that you might have. Okay. So I guess that sort of wraps up in terms of today's call on sort of the scenarios. Just in terms of some logistical items, you know, going forward, we are going to be using the Confluence website more and more to post materials and share content. So everyone should have the link to the Confluence website. We will send it out again outside of this call so everyone has access to it. And we'll be posting all the materials there as well. And then just as a reminder, our next meeting is on February 3rd at 1 p.m., okay? And at that meeting, we will, you know, bring back the behavioral health scenarios that will be fleshed out further, and then we'll have some new scenarios that we will discuss with you as well. Okay, I think with that, just one last item. These are all the links to sort of the relevant items on the Confluence website. Everyone has access to the slides that came out in the email, but we'll also send these links out separately as a follow-up, okay? And I think with that, we are sort of pretty much wrapped up. I'll say one last thing. You know, I think on a previous call we had mentioned that there is a parallel project on patient choice. And for individuals on this call that are interested in at least sort of keeping up to date or even following the progress of this project, this is the link to sort of the website. And they've also, you know, are posting all of the content online. Okay. And then finally, we have, you know, all the upcoming meetings that have been scheduled, and everyone should have calendar invitations already blocking out this time. So I think that sort of wraps up our call this afternoon. Again, thank you very much for your time, and we look forward to talking to you all again in about 2 weeks. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes your conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect. You may now